those buses?
Conductor's in the metaphysical.
Okay, cool. See ya. Hey, guys, which one of these makes me look more like a doctor?
Who was on the phone?
The Stonebrook Theater. There's a goat on the loose.
I'm in the load of the car.
Whoa. Okay.
Look at this beauty!
What did you do to my uncle's hearse?
I fixed it.
Man, this is so inappropriate for this vehicle.
Oh, we have fun.
Woo!
Let's go.
Oh, do you
want to?
Sorry. I'll let you.
Yeah, I regret for even making you have to listen to 10 measly seconds of that terrible Ghostbusters theme. It's awful. I don't know why they put that in there, but don't worry. When we get to the breaks, we'll play the good stuff. Welcome, everybody, to Cinema Royale. I'm Travis Hobson of the Punch Drunk Critics and the Broadcast Film Critics Association and more. And this week's show, we're dedicating it completely to Ghostbusters. And the reason why I wanted to do that is because there's been so much damn controversy about this movie for reasons that, I'll be honest, still kind of just confused the shit out of me. I don't understand why people have been so up in arms about this movie. It's essentially a reboot of the 1984 film that we all love. Hey, I love it too, with Bill Murray and Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson. Everybody likes that movie, you know, it's a classic. But it's a reboot, and people have been going up in arms about it being rebooted, which, for one, I'm like, okay, did you guys ever see Ghostbusters 2? It's awful. Why do you care? What difference does it make? And I think that what people are really upset about is that it's all women, and we'll talk about that in just a few minutes with my friend Kristen Lopez. I had to bring a woman in here to talk about Ghostbusters. I could not have a woman to talk about Ghostbusters. That would seem like it would be sort of tasteless. So, of course, I brought her in here to help me do that. So, of course, you can follow the show and follow me on Twitter, at Punchy Critic. You can follow us on Facebook as well. And this has been a really busy week, and next week is going to be busy as well, but not as busy as usual. You guys know, usually every year around this time, I'm gearing up to go to Comic-Con, and normally I'd bring the show with me. I'll do a spot from Comic-Con. I'll have an interview from Comic-Con. But this year, I'm actually taking a year off. I'm not going. There's no particular reason other than the fact that I'm just not in the mood this year. It's an exhausting 4 days. I don't sleep maybe more than 8 hours total across 4 days, which is just insane. And I'm not really in the mood for it this year. I'm already tired, and I don't know if I'd be able to survive 4 days of Comic-Con right now. So next week we'll not be doing the show from Comic-Con for the first time in a while. But I will be back next year. It's already set in stone for next year, so I will be there. But it's just this year I'm taking a break. So I'll be covering the show, and probably better from here. It's easier to cover Comic-Con from across the state, from across the country, than it is to actually be there, because it's just so chaotic. So no Comic-Con. But this week has also been Star Wars Celebration been going on for the last few days. So if you've been checking out PunchDrunkCritics.com, which I know you have, then we've been following the goings on there. We've had the live stream up for the last few days as well. So it's over now. It ended today. The live stream is still going on though. They're just running it in a loop, so you can actually probably still go to the site and watch some of what went down. I would say try your best to check out the Star Wars Rebels panel, because it's amazing. And there's some awesome stuff coming out for that show as it goes into season 3. I love that show. But anyway, let's stick with Ghostbusters here. And to talk about Ghostbusters is Kristen Lopez from Journeys in Classic Film, correct?
Yes. One of many, many outlets.
Oh, I can't hear you very well. Hold on. Say again.
One of many, many outlets. I write everywhere.
Ooh. I'm having a hard time hearing you. I'm not sure what's going on. Check your mic volume, Kristen.
I'm using my phone. So hold on one sec.
Yeah,
it's at maximum volume.
Fine. All of a sudden, I can't hear you anymore.
Yeah, the volume on my phone's at full blast.
I can't hear you at all. Hold on one second. Okay, Kristen's going to try and call back in and see if that'll fix the issue. All of a sudden, I couldn't hear her. I heard her just fine not more than 2 minutes ago before the show started. So let's hope that fixes things and we'll be able to talk to her about Ghostbusters, because I really want to get a woman's perspective on it and not just have it just be me. And let's see if this fixes it. Kristen, you there?
Is it any better?
Yeah, still.
I mean, I can use...
Still can't hear you.
Then I'm going to have to switch to my laptop. Which
there we go.
Speak. Oh, it's
there
better?
We go.
Okay.
There we
I was
going
to say,
yeah,
I really don't want to have to... Okay, I was going to say, I really don't want to switch to my computer, because that's going to take like 20 minutes to load.
We got it. No, we're good. We're good. Okay, now I can hear you just fine. Okay, so I hope you heard my intro. We're going to talk about Ghostbusters, and I really want to get your opinion on this. As a woman, of course. And now this is the movie is directed by Paul Feig, who did Bridesmaids and The Heat and Spy, which Spy might be my favorite out of the three of those. I think he's an amazing director. Well, maybe not the best director, but he's great at directing movies for women. And Ghostbusters, to me, always had a ton of potential. Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, Leslie Jones, Kate McKinnon, all very, very talented and funny women. But, of course, there's always the potential for, you know, any reboot to be a disappointment. But to me, this was pretty much, if I was going to say I wanted a Ghostbusters reboot, this was about as good as I could imagine it being. But let's get your opinion first, Kristen. What did you think of Ghostbusters?
Well, it's funny that you said that everybody loves the original Ghostbusters, because I'm in the minority on that. I don't really like the I've seen the original. I thought it was okay. I don't know, maybe it was
My take on the original is that it's not laugh out loud funny. It's more peculiar, but I like that aspect of it. You know, a lot of people find it really, really funny. I don't find it really, really funny. I find it peculiar, but peculiar in a charming way. And that's kind of how I feel about this one too, but I'll let you go ahead.
Yeah. So I don't really have that deep affinity for the original. So when they said they were going to remake this, I was like, okay. When they said that it was going to be Paul Feig and his kind of cast of his stable of actors, I was really excited. I mean, Melissa McCarthy and him have not steered me wrong. I love that Paul Feig takes these male dominated genres, whether it's the buddy comedy or the James Bond-esque film, and he's done successfully, you know, showing them up as, you know, you can have women in them. And I thought this was really good. It has some serious story problems, and I think in certain elements tries to kind of backdoor apologize in some instances, or at least try to justify its existence. But overall, I had a lot of fun. I liked it a lot more than I anticipated, mostly because of the name. I thought that, you know, the Ghostbusters name was going to involve a lot of callbacks to the original. It was going to essentially do the 21 Jump Street route, which is just kind of try to, you know, make it better than the original. And I thought it succeeded. It was a lot of funny moments, a lot of nice little pointed commentary. I thought Kate McKinnon pretty much cemented the fact that she deserves an action franchise, because I thought she was so fantastic in it. And finally, Chris Hemsworth proves that he has comedic chops. I mean, I thought he was funny in the Vacation reboot. I know a lot of people hated that movie, but he kind of proves that comedy might be... He's trying to prove that comedy might be his niche. So I thought it was good. I think the third act is probably the worst element.
All right, well, let's talk about Chris Hemsworth for a second. Chris Hemsworth is a funny guy. I think he has moments of being funny in the Avengers movies too. The reason why he's funny here is because he's making fun of himself. And he's you know, he's having fun with the idea of making fun of himself. You know, all looks, no brains. A real idiot. He's having. That's why he's so funny here. And
that,
you know, normally
also,
that's the kind of. Normally, that's the kind of role you see, you know, a female play, and where she's usually all looks and no and nothing else about her, nothing of substance at all. That's what's fun about it.
That's where I think it's interesting. I'm actually in the process of writing an article about this right now. Is that the character he's playing? Which it's been interesting hearing men say, why is it okay for women to objectify men, but men can't objectify women, and I just kind of want to slap them in the face. But the concept with Chris Hemsworth's character is that, you know, Kristen Wiig has that kind of running gag where she's subtly sexually harassing him, or at least trying to hit on him without success.
There's nothing subtle about it. There's nothing subtle about it.
And it's the concept, you know, for me, I think it works well because all the women are... either Kristen Wiig is, I think, the only one with at least any type of overt sexuality. The rest of them are just kind of asexual. And it's a very positive, non-threatening depiction of sexuality. And Chris Hemsworth's character is just unaware of it. But at the same time, he plays into it, like the clip you played, where, you know, he's got the pictures of him trying to be a doctor, and it's him without a shirt on. So he knows himself
right.
that he's good-looking and that, you know, women dig him. So I think it's a really nice little back and forth, at least presenting, like, hey, you know, women and men can subtly kind of, you know, flirt with each other, and it doesn't have to be... it's not something that, you know, women can have this positive depiction of sexuality and still be incredibly intelligent women at the same time. You don't have to sacrifice one for the other.
Right. Well, there's nothing respectful by anything that Kristen Wiig's doing when she's trying to flirt with her character at all. I mean, it's she puts it all out there, and I'm actually I disagree with you. I think he actually knows what she's doing. I think he's not being oblivious, and he's just ignoring her anyway.
Exactly.
But you're right that the other women aren't really interested in him at all, which I think is very interesting as well. And they are sort of asexual. Melissa McCarthy's character is just pure brains. That's all she's about. Brains and eagerness is really what she's all about. And Leslie Jones was probably my favorite of the bunch. And I think part of the reason why I liked her so much is because there was so much criticism about her role before anybody had even seen any of it, really. Once they found out that her character was, you know, a subway worker. And, you know, my point was always, let's wait and see how she actually is in the movie. Because I think what people were expecting was that she was going to be badly underwritten the way Ernie Hudson was in the original Ghostbusters, where his character was just totally marginalized the entire time. I mean, he not only was he not a scientist, but he didn't really add anything to the group. I mean, not really. But Leslie Jones' character actually does. I mean, she may not be, you know, a brainiac like the rest of them, but she's as smart as they are in a totally different way. And which you know, her knowledge of the city, her knowledge of history, you know, gave her an advantage that the other women did not have. And I thought that was one of the best things about the movie was the way her character was depicted.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at, you know, when Ernie Hudson's been very vocal about the original script that he read when he was given the role had a lot of stuff for him to do, and Bill Murray and Harold Ramis kind of said that they noticed he got a lot of the best jokes and they kind of took them for themselves. And so you know, when that first trailer came out and it emphasized that she was street smart, everybody just kind of rolled their eyes. And I've had a couple friends ask me, you know, is she playing the sassy black lady? And yeah, there are elements of that. I think there's a joke in there. There's a joke in there that I think was a little tone deaf, at least where I think it's Kristen Wiig's character says we're three scientists and Patty. And I was like, come on. Like, did we really need to point that out? But overall, I mean, without spoiling anything, Leslie Jones's character comes up with the climax of how to solve everything. I mean, I thought that was really unique. And you're right, her emphasis on history, which I think is something that you don't see enough of in films is, you know, not just science and STEM careers, but just, you know, kind of frivolous careers in film, like an appreciation of the past and all of that. I think that works better with it, with Leslie Jones's character than it does with the villain, who has this emphasis on the past that makes very little sense.
Yeah. Yeah, the villain wasn't too great in this movie, to be honest. Guy played by Neil Casey, and he's struggling. He's a total misfit, and he's trying to bring about some sort of apocalypse on the city. So, you know, in essence, it's not that different plot wise from the original, really. It's the details that are different. But the villain didn't do a whole lot for me. I didn't really care about the villain at all until he actually switched bodies later on. And I don't want to spoil who he switches bodies with, but I didn't really care about the villain all that much until that point, you know, so it's a bad guy.
The actual stakes, I think, are where the movie starts to wobble. That's why I said I think the third act is a bit of a mess, because we have this whole, it can't just be the paranormal activity is, you know, coming up in the city, and that the women have to prove themselves as not just women Ghostbusters, but the ghosts exist, because I love the little running gag between Cecily Strong and them about how they can acknowledge that they're doing good work in private, but they can't actually call them frauds. They have to call them frauds in public. But the villain, when we actually have a tangible villain, that's where I think the movie was kind of trying to justify its existence a little bit. He's the poor white guy who's probably the internet troll that's probably commenting about, you know, how horrible the trailer is for this movie. and his whole ultimate scheme about bringing things back to the glory days without spoiling anything, it makes no sense. Like, why does he pick the time period he picks?
Yes.
Why does it look like the way it looks? And that's where I was like, what's the mythology here? There's no real foundation for his end game other than it just looks really cool when it's all, you know, when all the ghosts show up in New York.
It didn't make any sense. But to your point, though, I actually don't think the villain exemplified any of those things you were talking about, because this movie has no issues being really direct about the online trolls who've been attacking this movie. It makes at least three or four really pointed jokes that are clearly targeted at those people. And I know because, you know, I saw it, but even the people who were in the screening with me, they all recognized it and laughed.
Oh yeah.
So I don't know if it really needed to be subversive when it came to the villain, because it was really, really out on Front Street, everything else it was trying to say.
Yeah. I think the jokes where they bring up the internet controversy, you know, ain't no bitches gonna bust no ghosts, I thought that's the best line ever. But I think that his character exemplifies kind of the ultimate internet troll. I think that that's where the metaphor, I think, goes from a pointed one-liner to kind of just being too big at that point. Like, we kind of get it. And I think that's why he ultimately doesn't feel so threatening. And you're right, it works best when he switches bodies, because it's a character that we've spent time with and that we understand, and it works better. I don't know how they could have fixed that problem without really either tacking on additional backstory or something. I think Paul Feig said his original cut was like 4 hours. So I don't know if anything got lost in terms of trying to build the villain up, but he's definitely, I think, the apotheosis of what they're trying to say with, you know, the women literally have to take on, you know, the nerdy white guy who's been talking down to them throughout the whole movie.
Yeah. Well, I think that all they really needed to do was have him be more than just some weird guy, because for much of the movie, that's really all he was. We didn't understand what his motivation was. I get what his goal is, but we don't know what his motivation is. Like, we don't understand why he wants to do this. I guess we're supposed to just figure out he's probably been bullied, he's been an outsider his entire life. Yeah, okay, I get that. But what made him come up with this idea to bring about an apocalypse? What made him come up with this very, very specific idea? You know what I mean? That's the only thing that didn't really work out for me. And so, you know, and like I said, that's the one thing that I was like,
It's very much like, and I kind of, when I reviewed it, I said his motivations I couldn't think of anything offhand, but I know we've seen that type of character several times this year. And it's in countless Disney movies, that concept of people look down on me, so I'm going to have this grand plan so that eventually I can rule over them and exterminate them. It's a very generic motivation that he's got. And there's really no basis for it. And there's no basis for how his end goal translates into, like, it's like he goes from, it's almost like Jim Carrey is the Riddler in Batman Forever, you know? He's got this, like, somebody's made fun of me, I'm going to hold on to it and let it fester, and then it would be like if the Riddler decided at the 11th hour, I'm going to dress up like this, and I'm going to bring ghosts out. Like, wait, what? You had me at one element, and then you just kind of jumped into something completely different.
Yeah, it seems like he really needed to have, like, it seems like he should have been, like, the sidekick guy, not the main guy. And maybe that's where they probably should have had Andy Garcia's mayor character be a little bit more evil. I mean, maybe
that's what I was kind of waiting for, yeah.
Yeah, I was waiting
for that. I think they could have made it tighter. They didn't really need a big bat. I think it would have just been easier having them try to prove themselves to New York. You don't need to, you know, emphasize. You don't need to narrow it even further to one guy. You know, it could have just been ghosts are taking over for reasons, because they're ghosts, and, you know, they have to prove their legitimacy, and they have to, you know, go against the mayor and all of that. I think they tried to jumble too much in terms of what they're up against, when they could have just made it cleaner by eliminating a couple things.
Yeah. We got a number of cool cameos in the movie. I think everybody knows by now that pretty much everybody from the original movie who's still alive, minus Rick Moranis, shows up in this movie.
Harold Ramis does get a statue, so.
He does. He absolutely does get a statue, yes. What did you think about the cameos? Did any of them work for you? I thought Bill Murray was pretty good in the scenes he had.
Bill Murray was probably the only one that actually had any integration, and that's another thing where, and a lot of people have said that they assumed that he was going to take on a role similar to the antagonist in the first film, and we set him up as kind of, again, this big bad, possibly because he's a rival ghost whisperer, so to speak, who thinks that they're frauds, and I thought, okay, well, it's going to come up against the two of them, and then we very quickly eliminate him, like almost Zombieland style, because I guess Bill Murray was tired of being on screen at that point. So I kind of wish we had done more with him because we set him up so much. The other cameos are just kind of like, oh, hey, hi, you're here. So the Aykroyd one is about on par with his cameo in Casper. I thought Ernie Hudson was pretty funny. And Annie Potts, I was so happy to see her. I thought she was really funny as well. But really, Bill Murray's the only one that has any type of weight. It moves kind of beyond a cameo at that point.
Yeah, I agree. So overall, does this Ghostbusters make you feel like you want to see another one? Because you know Sony's trying to build this huge franchise out of Ghostbusters now. But would you want to see another one with these same four women involved?
Oh, definitely. Now that the whole setup and the justification for it is out of the way, I want to see something original. You know, give me a story, put the Ghostbusters in a situation where they're established, we know who they are, you don't have to deal with exposition and setting them up, and let them actually do something really cool. So I'm excited to see it. I will watch anything else where Kate McKinnon is going to do something, because I love her so much. So I'm excited to see where it goes, and hopefully this will allow more original, you know, female movies to be supported by major studios and get some money behind them.
Yeah. All right, well, let's take a quick break and let's talk about that a little bit. We're going to talk about some of the reaction to Ghostbusters and a little bit about why people are so upset about it. So let's take a quick break and we'll talk about that on the other side, okay?
Yeah. afraid of no ghosts.
Puppy, I like to call a ghost chipper.
You truly scare me. I just want to let you know that.
I'm gonna just.
Oh, it's like Mardi Gras in there.
It's a proton glove. It's gonna maximize flexibility during hand to specter combat. Just give it a punch, it's motion activated.
All right, and we're back. Talking Ghostbusters with Kristen Lopez of Journeys in Classic Film. And did I remember you saying something about a podcast? Did you start a podcast recently as well?
I did. It's called Ticklish Business. It's a classic film podcast. I did my second episode last week about Olivia de Havilland's centennial. Next week, we're looking at Planet of the Apes. So it's been a lot of fun to do.
Good Lord. Where did that title come from? It has to be from something.
It's Jane Russell says it in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes in 1953. So that's where I took it from. Which, if you listen to the podcast, I did include a clip so that people didn't think it was some sort of weird, like, fetish site or something.
Yeah. Sure. It's not. I don't know if I believe you or not. I've seen your posts. I've seen your pictures. I know what you're all about.
Exactly. There's a lot of weird stuff out there about me on social media. So it's possible. It could be a whole dark, nefarious side of me.
There might be a website dedicated to, you know, fetishizing cute film critics. You never know. You might be on there. You might be on their front page.
Well, you know, we got to support some of the, I mean, you know, not to belittle the film critics out there, but, you know, we got to promote the pretty ones at least. And if I'm on that list.
There aren't very many.
I'm going to get many ugly emails now from people saying Kristen hates ugly critics.
I hate ugly critics, and I'll be the first to say it. So it's okay. It's all right. All right, but anyway, we're talking Ghostbusters here, and the movie actually started off pretty well at the box office this week. It opened with $46 million, and that's not too bad. It's not great either, though, and it makes me wonder if all of this negative controversy has had an impact on its box office. Now, the movie has been, like I said in the beginning of the show, the movie's been the subject of a lot of consternation. You know, a lot of people are upset over the fact that the movie's being rebooted, which, to me, you know, I get that aspect of it. People get upset over reboots all the time, but it seemed like there was an excessive amount of vitriol for this one, and I can only believe that it has to do with the fact that it's an all women's version of Ghostbusters. Would you agree with that? And if so, why do you think people care like that?
You know, it's interesting that a film that makes $46 million in this day and age is considered a flop, which, you know, in our landscape of if it doesn't make, you know, I forget what the threshold is with marketing, but I think they said like $100 million is anything $100 million or less is considered a disappointment. And we've had some big ones. I mean, Independence Day Resurgence hasn't hit $100 million yet, and that was way more money.
Yeah, well, that's domestic. So, it's got $300 million worldwide. And nowadays, you can't just look at the domestic numbers. It always has to do with the worldwide numbers. And Independence Day has over $300 million worldwide, so it's actually doing okay. But, you know, Ghostbusters has not gone internationally. Well, it has gone internationally, but it's only got $19 million internationally, so it's at $65 million. The problem with Ghostbusters, and it's the same problem that has afflicted The Legend of Tarzan, which has actually done fairly well domestic, it's the fact that it costs $180 million. Now,
exactly.
Ghostbusters cost $144 million. I don't know why it needed to cost $144 million, but it did. And that's why it looks not like a flop, but like a marginal hit at this point, when it should be, under normal circumstances, $46 million is tremendous.
Yeah, and you have to look at, I mean, women's films, films with more than two women in a cast, this is why it's the litmus test. You know, they're going to look at that $46 million, and they're going to say, how much has that played into the fact that it's a predominantly female cast? Which I think is ridiculous in 2016 that that's what we have to say. Like, how little money did it make be fair on the fact that it's got women in it? It's why women's films don't get the studio backing. They don't get $140 million budget to be made because studios assume there's no money in them. And I think, yeah, part of it definitely has to do with the fact that there was a lot of backlash against it. I think the name recognition didn't help in terms of people saying they weren't going to go see it, because whether they say it was because of female casting or because they don't like Melissa McCarthy or Paul Feig or that combination.
Which we know is not true. We know
exactly.
That's not true. We know that's not true because they've gone to see their other movies to a tremendous degree. They've gone to see their movies together. So we know that's not it.
I mean, I'd like to say part of it might be, I mean, you bring up The Legend of Tarzan, just how much time has passed. And I think that that always plays a factor into reboots of this type. I mean, I think that sites have done surveys looking at how far in between either sequels or remakes, or whether it's a TV show, when the TV show ended and when the movie comes out. You know, you definitely have, I think, that time period where the time is right. And after a certain point, you're going to have to work harder to get people. Name recognition doesn't sell automatically. You know, Tarzan as a title doesn't sell automatically like it would have, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, or, you know, even further than that. So I also think that might have had a factor, is that we waited so long. You know, Bill Murray and crew had said for so many years that it was going to happen, that they had had plans for Ghostbusters 3, and then that didn't happen. That I hate to say misogyny is why it didn't make a lot of money, but I certainly think that the amount of time that passed from the second one, which was, you know, critically derided when it came out, and this might have had a hand, is that people were just like, Ghostbusters with women, you know, it's been so long and I have to look at ladies, you know, that's just ludicrous. I can't do it.
But the response to that is of course, you know, Jurassic World, which was out for which took how many years between that one, before that one came out? Was that close to 20 years also? I mean,
was it 20 years? I have no idea. I hated that movie, so I tried to forget.
I don't know. I don't remember.
Jurassic World exists.
Yeah, I don't remember either. In fact, I just put a GIF of it up yesterday. I was talking about how yesterday was the anniversary of it coming out, of Jurassic Park 3. So you think I would remember, and yet I don't. I still don't remember.
It's because Jurassic Park 3 is about on par with Jurassic World. Nobody needs to remember it.
2001, so 15 years. 15 years between movies. Hey, Jurassic World is really good, in my opinion, so it's way off.
We'll agree to disagree on that one. That's a whole other talking point right there.
Well, but I mean, but it's true in a sense, though, that, you know, taking a long time between movies does matter more in some cases than in others. And maybe it is in regards, when it comes to Ghostbusters, that there had been literally 20 years of, you know, of buildup for a third movie, which is why it's kind of ironic that Bill Murray plays such a significant role in this one, considering he's the guy who basically made sure there was no Ghostbusters 3. I mean, it's all because of him, basically, that there's no Ghostbusters 3. He would literally shred every script that they sent him. But Paul Feig comes up with this reboot, and he's all gung-ho for it. He's down with it, you know? So that's kind of
and
ironic.
I think it's important to note, you know, the coveted 18 to 24 demographic, which, you know, my little brother has never seen Ghostbusters. He wasn't born when it came out. So you have a lot of the younger generation who goes to see movies opening day, who have, you know, either a very tenuous or no connection to the original, who are probably going into this completely cold, you know, thinking that there's no precedent for it at all. And I think that that might also factor in, you know, the concept like Ghostbusters. I have no concept of what that is. It looks stupid. You know, I think there's a lot of factors that play into this that might have contributed. But I think time's going to tell in the next couple of weeks, because it's unfortunate that this is going to be the watermark for whether we allow women to create more big budget films, you know, because if it fails, they're going to say, well, it was because they were women. You know, it's not going to be because of the release date or because, you know, the reviews weren't outstanding. It's going to be, well, it's because they were women.
Yeah. And this is the way it goes for virtually any specific group in Hollywood, unless you're, you know, white males. Whenever there's an African-American movie, if it fails, then all of African-American cinema fails. You know,
exactly.
if there's an African American director who makes a movie and it doesn't do anything, well, that means less jobs all around for African American filmmakers. And it's just like, it's not fair, but it happens to women too. You know, it happens for women led movies. It definitely happens to female directors.
I mean, it's definitely more, I'm more interested in seeing, you know, Patty Jenkins do Wonder Woman, because that's going to determine whether women are actually going to be able to direct these big, you know, big budget films. Paul Feig's going to be fine. You know, whether this movie does good or bad, he's going to be able to make movies. It's not going to affect his career at all. And I think that that's where, for me, Ghostbusters is a step. But it's only a step, because it would have been a bigger risk had it been a $140 million movie starring women, directed by a woman. And, you know, even though this is co-written by a woman, if it had just been a woman credit, like if it had been the true triple threat, like that would have been like the glass ceiling just shattering. But Paul Feig will be fine no matter what. You know, it's definitely more of a challenge if we get a female director directing a multi-million dollar studio film, and that does good or bad.
Right, right. And every time I think about that, I always think of Lexi Alexander, who did Punisher Warzone, which I actually liked a lot and I thought was better than the first Punisher movie. But nobody went to see it. In fact, nobody went to see it. It made like $10 million. It did something horrible. And that affected any females from getting, you know, blockbuster movies for a long time. And, you know, that's why it was such a big deal when Warner Brothers decided to do Wonder Woman and hire, well, first Michelle McLaren and then Patty Jenkins. It was a really big deal because women had not been behind the camera of a superhero movie since. So it's always huge when these things happen, and I'm rooting for Ghostbusters to be a success. One, because I like everybody involved, from Paul Feig to the cast, and I even like Katie Dippold as a writer, although I was not a big fan of The Heat, but it's okay. You know, I'm a big fan of all of them, and I want to see them succeed. And what do I necessarily care about the franchise succeeding? I really don't care about that so much. I care about these people succeeding so that they can keep making movies like this. I think it's also important to
note the fact that, you know, not only is this a gamble because it's women, but it's also older women, because if memory serves, all of our four are over 30, correct? I'm thinking, I know Melissa McCarthy is, and I know Kristen Wiig is, and I'm sure Leslie Jones is. Kate McKinnon's kind of the outlier. I don't know how old she is. But, I mean, it's very hard to get women who are over, you know, a certain 32. Age. Exactly. So it's very rare to see, you know, a woman over a certain age, you know, let alone more than one woman over 30, you know, leading a tentpole. You know, you look at who they originally were considering, because I think they said at one point Emma Stone was going to be in this, and Jennifer Lawrence, you know, girls in their, you know, early 20s, mid to early 20s right there. So it's definitely great to see women who are actually, you know, in the womanly age, even though the whole ghost girls thing that kind of plays out, I just kind of kept like saying, girls, they're not 18, you know, they're ghost women. Can we give them the correct term?
Calm down, Kristen. They're referring to something from high school.
I know the logic behind it. It's just, it keeps perpetuating the stereotype that if a woman is not a girl, she is not of value.
Oh, Kristen. Kristen. Don't take it so seriously. It's okay.
No, you can't argue. I read, what is it? What am I reading right now? I'm reading like a 500-page feminist text right now. So I am.
No.
I got my
no
feminist
one,
cap on.
No wonder. No wonder. Okay. You're
exactly.
You're
again,
okay.
Please send all your snarky comments to Kristen at yesimafeministandimnotapologizing.com.
There's nothing wrong with being a feminist, but...
Exactly. Thank you.
All right. Well, Kristen, this has been a lot of fun, of course, as always, whenever you come on here. I really appreciate it. Tell everybody a little bit about Journeys in Classic Film, and tell everybody what you got coming up with your podcast as well, real quick.
Yeah, I my main blog is journeysinclassicfilm.com. Right now I have a whole little tribute going on to Doris Day. You can also find me at spectrumculture.com or cinemacentries.com if you want to read some of my more contemporary stuff. I do have a Ghostbusters review up out there. You can also find me at medium.com/@KristenLopez. I'm also at Film School Rejects on occasion. And then ticklishbusiness.podbean.com is where you can find my podcast. I'm supposed to, hopefully, if all goes well this week, I will be recording with a special guest talking about TCM and Fathom Events' latest screening of Planet of the Apes, which I have actually never seen. I've seen the remake, the crappy Tim Burton remake, but I've never seen the original. So it should be an experience, because I've seen many a Charlton Heston film. This is the second of the year that I'm planning to see, because I have an episode that I'm planning to do on Ben-Hur. But yeah, this will be an interesting one for me, because I know everything
you're
about
go
Planet
watch
of the
Ben-Hur
Apes.
Before the remake. So you want to watch
yes,
Ben-Hur?
Yes, I am. I will be watching the remake. I told somebody. Somebody told me because I mentioned that I was going to see the Ben-Hur remake because I have personal bias in that one. But somebody said, well, you have to watch the original, and it's like, or you have to at least watch the 59 because I know there's a silent version of Ben-Hur. And I said, well, I'll watch the Heston one, and then that's the only one I'm going to watch next to the remake. So I have a 4-hour epic that I have to take time for in the next couple of weeks.
Please note, everyone, that she is talking about all these future plans for her show and stuff, and not one of those involved inviting me to be on it. So just everybody, please.
You are
that.
More than welcome, of course.
You know
of
what?
Course.
I think you probably are too deep into classic film for me. If I come on there, it's going to have to be for something very specific that I know about. But I think you might know.
Yeah, many people that I've asked have said, you know, what's your cutoff? And I'll go to about 79-ish. So, yeah, I try not to go into the 80s and above because at that point you get a lot of angry classic film fans who don't even think I should be looking at the 70s. So, yes, of course, if you have a pre-1980s film that you're passionate about, get in touch with me off air, and I will schedule you on because it'd be awesome to have you.
All right. Well, I will definitely keep in touch with you about that then. And, of course, I'll keep in touch with you through Facebook and stuff anyway because, you know, We attractive film critics need to stick together because there's only a few of us.
Despite my feminist leanings.
You're not one of the heinous feminists. You know, you're actually semi attractive too. So that's okay. But
there's so
like
much stereotyping.
You're not like the other one. No, I'm just kidding. But we'll definitely keep in touch and. And I will have you on again soon because I love having you on here. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. Anytime.
All right. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Awesome. Talk soon. Bye.
All right. Bye. All right, everybody. That was Kristen Lopez of Journeys in Classic Film and her podcast, Ticklish Business. And we are about to break out of here. It is about a quarter after. Yeah, so we're about 45 minutes in. Where's my outro music? There it is. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to Cinema Royale this week. I had a lot of fun, as always. Next show, which should be next week, we'll be talking about Jason Bourne. Oh, God, I can't wait. Is it Jason Bourne? Yeah. No, Star Trek. Star Trek or Jason Bourne. One or the other. We'll talk about one, maybe one or both. I see them both next week, so... but anyway, this has been Cinema Royale. I'm Travis Hobson. Thank you for tuning in. This has been great. Be sure to follow us on Facebook. Facebook and on Twitter, and I will talk to you later. Goodbye.